Somewhere deep in the mountains of Mexico's Sierra Madre, a former Olympic snowboarder has vanished. Protected by the same cartel that once operated under one of the world's most notorious criminals, El Chapo, Ryan Wedding has become one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, with a $10 million bounty on his head. The charges? Masterminding a billion-dollar cocaine empire, moving 60 tons annually across four countries. There's also the charges for ordering executions of rivals and debtors, whilst also leaving a couple dead in a case of mistaken identity. And yet he's built connections so deep with one of Mexico's top cartels that they now shield him from international law enforcement. This isn't the story of a street hustler who clawed his way up through the drug trade. Instead, it's the transformation of a gifted athlete who once wore his country's colors at the Winter Olympics. And in many ways, Wedding took the opposite path to many in the drug industry. Rather than starting from nothing and using crime as a ladder to escape poverty, he has somehow descended from privilege and opportunity to falling down into the criminal underworld, becoming one of the top 10 most wanted men in the world. And his story shows that sometimes the allure of power and risk can be more seductive than even Olympic glory. It was April 1st, 2024. A contract killer known as Mr. Perfect pulled up to the home of 29-year-old Randy Fader in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Randy, a father of two with a neat beard and tattoo-covered arms, never made it past his driveway. Mr. Perfect shot him four times at close range, and then dramatically fled in a white Audi SUV. Mr. Perfect had a list, and Randy just happened to be the first. It was quickly uncovered that the hit had been ordered by someone known as Miro Wiro, also known ominously as the Dictator, who had provided Mr. Perfect with Randy's address and promised him $100,000 and called it a simple driveway job. Later that night, the killer photographed his 9mm handgun alongside stacks of cash, captioning the image "Good night." He believed he had executed a perfect hit, but he didn't live up to his namesake. Within days, police identified the Audi through CCTV footage. 2 weeks after the murder, they arrested Mr. Perfect driving a Ford Explorer in Toronto. Searching the vehicle, they found 9mm bullets, the cash payment, and a white iPhone containing his entire conversation history with Miro Wiro, whose real name was discovered to be Andrew Clark, including Fader's address and a list of other potential targets. And above Andrew Clark in the pecking order was somehow a former Olympian who was rubbing shoulders with the Sinaloa cartel, KGB agents, and even Hezbollah operatives. And that man is Ryan Wedding. He had built one of the most sophisticated drug trafficking networks in North America. At his peak, authorities estimated Wedding's crew was moving up to 60 tons. At one point, revenue topped an estimated $1 billion annually. And now, people were starting to get killed about this. As the FBI's most wanted list says coldly, Wedding and Clark's organization resorted to violence, including multiple murders to achieve its aims. As you can see, Wedding isn't just some street-level dealer. He was a businessman, disciplined, strategic, and invincible. And yet when it all began in the beginning, he was never any of those things. And his rise to infamy is one of the most shocking and unusual narcotic stories there's ever been. And it all began in Park City, Utah. It was February 2002, the air was crisp and thin at 7,000 feet elevation, and the sky was a beautiful blue canvas against the Grand Mountain landscape. The start signal beeped, and Ryan Wedding launched himself from the chute. His 6'4", 240-pound frame thundered down the mountain at the Winter Olympics. The crowd below watched intently as the Canadian Olympian carved his way down the mountain. This was the culmination of years of dedication and thousands of practice runs. But then, something went wrong. The snow conditions had changed between his practice runs and competition, turning soft and slushy, so by the third gate, Wedding realized his strategy wouldn't work, but momentum was giving him no chance to adjust, meaning he finished 24th in his category, missing advancement by just over a second. At the Olympics, Wedding got a taste of stardom. He was receiving free gear from Nike and rubbed shoulders with pro hockey players he'd seen on TV. During the opening ceremonies, he called his mom, excitedly asking if she could come see him on TV. The cameras were all on him and he loved it. His former coach Bobby Allison would later recall that Wedding has something essential for elite competition, a complete absence of fear. To quote Allison, a lot of kids, they say they want to go fast, but they don't really want to go fast. They hold something back because there's a little bit of fear there for fooling. Which is why Allison and others thought this was just the beginning for the young athlete. He had made the Olympic team earlier than expected and his future seemed limitless. However, it was not to be. And the same fearlessness that propelled Wedding to snowboarding success would eventually lead him down a very different path. After the Salt Lake Olympics, Wedding was devastated. He stopped being an Olympian and enrolled at Simon Fraser University near Vancouver, telling his parents he was going to do a career change. And instead of being an Olympian, he wanted to become a stockbroker or even just join his father's engineering firm. He just wanted a solid path and to make some good money. And to earn some extra money, he also took a job as a bouncer at Vancouver nightclubs. And this was the decision that would ultimately alter the course of his entire life. With Mother's Day coming up, I wanted to share a gift idea that's both thoughtful and practical. Raycon's Everyday Earbuds. Whether your mum's on the go, working out, or taking yet another call on a speakerphone, these earbuds are designed to fit seamlessly into her day. Raycon's Everyday Earbuds are an amazing gift. First, you've got the 38-hour battery life, which is a game changer, meaning your mum won't need to worry about constantly recharging. And if she's ever in a rush, just 10 minutes of charging gives 90 minutes of playback thanks to the quick charge feature. And Raycon's new model also now includes active noise cancellation, so that she can actually enjoy a moment of peace, whether that's during a walk, a podcast break, or just a call with you. And with the multi-point connectivity, she can then connect two devices at once, meaning no more switching between her phone and laptop. I mean, just personally, I use my Raycons every day, especially when I travel. They're comfortable, they don't fall out, and they sound amazing because they can block out all the sound on trains and flights so that I can really focus in on the music or podcast that I'm listening to. And when I'm traveling, it's just so useful having the new weatherproof design so that I don't have to worry about damaging them accidentally with everyday use on the go. Plus, the protective case cover supports wireless charging and comes in sleek, modern designs that match your style. So, if you're looking for a gift that's both affordable and genuinely useful, check out Raycon. They're half the price of other premium brands, and they offer a 30-day happiness guarantee, so it's risk-free. Just click the link in the description or go to buyraycon.com/moonyt to get 20% off site-wide, just in time for Mother's Day. That's buyraycon.com/moonyt, brought to you by Raycon. In the early 2000s, Vancouver offered a particular kind of opportunity for a young man with ambition, especially the wrong kind. Just 25 miles from the longest undefended border in North America, it was perfectly positioned for cross-border smuggling. A pound of BC bug could fetch $2,000 locally, but double that once it crossed into the US. Meanwhile, Vancouver's nightlife in the early 2000s was exploding with unprecedented violence. A gang war for control of the lucrative weed trade had erupted, with shootings becoming so common that police began roaming through bars, ejecting anyone who looked like a potential drug dealer. The established old-school crime syndicates like the Triads and Hells Angels knew better than to draw attention, but the new gangs, calling themselves the Red Scorpions and the United Nations, were hungry for recognition and flaunted their wealth and influence whenever they could. One of Wedding's first nights working the door at a club called Onyx didn't exactly go quietly. A fight broke out in the parking lot and it escalated fast. Before long, it was total chaos. Cars were screeching through the lot, weaving around bouncers and clubgoers, some even trying to run people down. At one point, a guy near Wedding, another bouncer, grabbed a hatchet off a patron in the middle of the fight. Then as a car came flying straight at them, he swung and slammed the blade right into the hood, which is one way to welcome someone to the job. This was such a brutal time that other bouncers started wearing bulletproof vests, but Wedding told his mother he didn't need one, he wasn't afraid. In fact, it was the complete opposite. He was finally hooked on something again. The chaos and danger of nightclub security might have filled a void left by competitive snowboarding. The adrenaline rush, the physical intimidation, and the constant tension all satisfied the same psychological needs that had once been met on the slopes. As Wedding spent more time in the clubs, the more he took on the mannerisms of his new friends, and he started dressing like them too. Prada shoes, Breitling watch, and Ed Hardy t-shirts. He became obsessed with getting bigger and stronger, telling friends he hated it when other guys at the gym were bigger than him. Brett Kalina, a former FBI agent who later arrested Wedding, talked about how he stuck out with his massive build, piercing blue eyes, and blonde hair. To quote, "It's pretty hard to hide a 6'4" white guy." There's a strange thing about Wedding's descent into the criminal underworld. He always had plenty of money. When he dropped out of college, his dad loaned him a cool $250,000 for a down payment on a house in Maple Ridge, a suburb north of Vancouver. Wedding then flipped this and made a quick easy $100,000. Because of this, he told people he was in real estate. He said he was an investor, but his friends couldn't help wondering if that was the whole story. Wedding's lifestyle was only becoming more lavish, and his professional athletic career was becoming more distant. Until 2006, when Wedding had his first real run-in with the law, Vancouver police raided his grow-up and hit the jackpot. Pot, with 6,800 marijuana plants, 86 pounds of dried product, and a couple of loaded guns locked away in a safe. All in all, this was worth around $10 million, the biggest grow-up ever busted in Maple Ridge. The police came this close to getting him, and they'll spend years wishing they had. But with nothing other than one informant linking Wedding to the operation, the police could never actually press charges. And imagine if you're him, you've put all of this wealth up, and you've just narrowly avoided a drug bust. This was a huge warning, enough to put most people off the trade. And Wedding could have easily retired at this stage, especially as he wasn't tied to a major operation yet and was small enough to walk away from the game, all with around $10 million. But you don't land on the FBI's most wanted list by playing it safe. For Wedding, that close call was less of a wake-up call and more of a speed bump on his first moving descent into the criminal world. However, it seemed to knock him off his balance temporarily, and his life seemed to become much less stable. By 2007, he was telling friends that he was now broke. He'd lost nearly $500,000 in shady real estate deals, and according to a later court testimony, another $300,000 in a cocaine deal that went sideways. He was growing pot, one of his friends would later recall, lots of it. Putting his early drug profits to use, Wedding snapped up a condo in Vancouver's posh Westwood Plateau and turned it into his personal playground, soaring 30 feet ceilings, oversized pillars, and his initials etched into the front entrance. The garage looked like a showroom, crowned with a Hummer, a pair of snowmobiles, and a BMW M5. This lifestyle required serious money to sustain, far more than occasional real estate flipping could ever provide. According to an informant, Wedding and a partner were quietly scaling up their operations, cultivating as many as 8,000 marijuana plants in a warehouse on a property owned by one of his friends. Every couple of weeks, Wedding would harvest the plants and sell them off to a broker, and the grow-op was pulling in serious money, hundreds of thousands a year, maybe more. Old friends said they'd see them lugging out garbage bags full of cash, and everything for them was going perfectly. The promising Olympian who'd once stood tall on the mountain had become something else entirely. A man so deep in desperation, he was willing to take bigger and bigger risks, and this was all leading him to a decision that would change everything. Desperate to bounce back from his financial troubles, Wedding linked up with Hassan Shirony, an Iranian immigrant living on Vancouver's north side. Hassan had been on the police radar since 1997, when a friend of his was shot and killed in a North Vancouver movie theater during a screening of the gangster flick Donnie Brasco. According to Hassan, Wedding approached him with a proposition, buying a large quantity of cocaine in California, and he claimed to have around $340,000 ready to go. Over the course of a few meetings between the duo and two men with ties to Russian organized crime, they collectively agreed to purchase 24 kilos of cocaine from a contact in LA. If the deal went smoothly, it would be the first of many. From the moment Wedding and Hassan touched down in LA in June 2008, the FBI was already tracking them. Wedding had never been involved in a deal of this scale before, and according to agents on the case, it was obvious. He didn't ask basic questions like where the product was coming from, and instead of sending someone else to make the pickup, he insisted on doing this himself. Still, he never acted nervous. If anything, he looked like a guy on vacation. He and Hassan slept in, grabbed breakfast at Denny's, and spent their evenings in hookah lounges. In the downtime, Hassan flipped through real estate magazines, casually scoping out properties in Southern California. After a couple of days, they then got the call. The deal was moving forward. Hassan had secured $100,000 in cash through a contact in LA's Iranian community, and they hid the money in the hotel room. Then they sent one of the Russians, a man named Michael Krapkin, down to the waterfront to buy a single kilo. If the quality checked out, he'd give the green light, and they'd move on the full shipment. And imagine you're a former Olympic athlete who's now sitting in a San Diego hotel room waiting for a phone call about 24 kilos of cocaine. To put that into perspective, this has a street value today of over $2 million. Under the dresser's $100,000 in cash, and all you need now is for your Russian associate to confirm the cocaine is good quality, and you'll be good on your way to recouping your losses, and maybe even setting yourself up for life. But then the phone rang, and it wasn't the Russians calling with good news. The buy had turned out to be a setup. The Russian was nabbed on the scene, and Hassan and Wedding were arrested in San Diego, leaving their hotel room where the FBI found the $100,000 hidden under a dresser, said Brett Kalina. To quote, he was on the recordings from the second he stepped down on US soil. Wedding evidently didn't learn from his first brush with law enforcement, and now he was standing there in handcuffs. However, what might have truly been the end of the Wedding story would instead become merely the prologue to a much darker chapter. His time in the American prison system would transform him from just an amateur drug trafficker into something far more dangerous. In the San Diego courtroom, Ryan Wedding didn't look like a man facing 10 years in a federal prison. Instead, he just looked bored and detached, as if the whole thing, the judge, the charges, the agents testifying against him, was just another minor annoyance in his day. He didn't argue, didn't flinch, and didn't show a hint of remorse. The prosecutors, expecting desperation or at least defiance, were thrown by the calm. Here was a former Olympian, a national athlete turned alleged drug trafficker, sitting stone-faced surrounded by lawyers and US marshals, while hours of recordings played out his voice on wiretapes, and not once did he try to cut a deal or ask for leniency. Even the judge seemed puzzled, but in the end, his bravado counted for nothing. He was found guilty of conspiring to traffic cocaine with a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years. But his legal team had a plan. If they could get that sentence trimmed just a little bit, then they could transfer to a Canadian prison, where time served would be way shorter thanks to a more lenient system. While he waited to be sentenced, he was held at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in San Diego, and it's known to be mostly full of federal inmates. Lots of low-level cartel guys, especially mules, bringing drugs over the border. And for Wedding, this was just an education. He paid attention and watched how things worked. He made connections, and the same competitive drive that made him an elite athlete kicked in again, just in a totally different world. He learned fast, moved smart, and navigated the prison hierarchy like he'd been doing it for years. Quote, "You've got people in that facility that have amazing drug world connections," Kleiner recalls. "We really did just turn him into a much better drug dealer than he ever was when he started with us." And in May 2010, Weddings' legal strategy finally paid off. His sentence was cut down to just 4 years, and the US agreed not to block his transfer to a Canadian prison, as long as he gave up $121,000 in assets. Quote, "As an athlete, I was always taught there is no second chances. And well, I'm here asking for exactly that," he told the judge. Not long after, Wedding was sent to Federal Correctional Institution Reeves in Texas, the largest for-profit prison in the world. When Wedding arrived, the prison housed nearly 4,000 inmates, mostly undocumented immigrants serving sentences related to drugs or immigration-related offenses. Prison gives you lots of time to think. Imagine yourself in Wedding's position, with concrete walls and endless hours to fill. For most, this would be rock bottom. We'd question every decision that led us to this point. Maybe we'd feel regret, shame, or a desire to change. But Wedding's mind worked differently. FBI agents heard him saying to visitors, "I'm meeting people, I'm learning." While the justice system thought it was punishing him, he saw the sentence as just an opportunity. During his time in prison, Wedding lived up to his name and married an Iranian-born BC businesswoman, who was later connected with a violent kidnapper in Vancouver. Every aspect of his life, even his marriage, was now tied to crime. In December 2011, Ryan Wedding finally walked out of prison and was deported back to Canada. But this was not a story of redemption. By 2013, he'd relocated to Montreal and had established himself within the city's criminal hierarchy. He now had a book full of criminal contacts, a sharper understanding of how the international drug trade really worked, and a reputation for keeping his mouth shut. People said he was solid, meaning he didn't talk no matter the pressure. And the timing, it was perfect, at least for someone looking to make moves in the narcotics industry. You see, Montreal's underworld was unstable at the time. Mob boss Vito Rizzuto had just come back from a 10-year stretch in the US, and the Hells Angels were still regrouping, as most of their top guys in Quebec were either in prison or facing charges from the bloody biker wars of the 90s. Meanwhile, someone else was quietly expanding into Canada, El Chapo and the notorious Sinaloa cartel. According to DEA agent Andrew Hogan, who helped take El Chapo down, the cartel had built a huge pipeline across the Americas. Cocaine crossed the US-Mexico border into Arizona, then sat in warehouses in Tucson or Phoenix, and made its way to the Washington state border. From there, helicopters flying low dropped shipments into the forests of British Columbia. As the cartel realized that Canada was a goldmine, and Canadian law enforcement, well, let's just say they weren't exactly built to handle cartels. And so by 2013, El Chapo was allegedly making more money from cocaine in Canada than in the United States. Also, Canada's drug world really doesn't run like Mexico's. It's much more entrepreneurial. You've got different crews working with the same cartel in the same city, sometimes without even knowing about each other. So by the time Wedding made his way to Montreal, the city's drug scene was wide open, especially for someone with solid Mexican connections, soon proving instrumental to El Chapo's expansion strategy. Wedding's name first popped up on law enforcement's radar again in January 2015, during an undercover operation called Harrington. An officer went to Montreal to meet a guy named Felipe Coyalos, someone known to be connected to El Chapo. According to court documents, Filipos brought the undercover cop to meet the so-called man in charge, and that man was Ryan Wedding. Wedding introduced himself to the officer as a cocaine importer. He talked casually about past deals in the Caribbean and floated the idea of using boats to move products to Newfoundland. and then trucks to get them into Montreal. By this point, Wedding was working with his right-hand man. Remember Andrew Clark, the dictator from earlier? Well, together, they were running a tightly organized crew. Communications happened through Threema, an encrypted messaging app based in Switzerland that doesn't store anything on its servers. They had truckers moving coke across the continent, money launderers handling millions in cash, and even a network of hitmen on standby. And anyone who got in the way? Well, let's just say they were promptly removed. That specific deal with the undercover officer eventually fell through, so Wedding couldn't be arrested. But over the next few years, the operation surrounding him only got bigger and more dangerous. Operation Harrington would become a turning point, not just for revealing Wedding's role as a high-level cocaine trafficker, but instead for what it exposed about his global reach. The investigation uncovered drug routes stretching from South America to the Caribbean, including Venezuela's Margarita Island, long suspected of being a hub for Iranian-backed Hezbollah operatives. At the same time, evidence pointed to Wedding's ties to the Iranian-linked money laundering networks, including one used in his first trafficking arrest, where $100,000 was moved through a channel run by an Iranian-Canadian associate. By this point, US authorities were drawing clear links between the cocaine trade, Iranian criminal networks, and rogue state actors. In a briefing to Congress, DEA Intelligence Chief Carrie Thompson warned of a growing nexus between drug trafficking and the financing of terrorist organizations, including the Iranian regime. Wedding, it seemed, wasn't just a player in North America's drug scene. He was tied to something massive. His operation had reached empire level. He was immersed in a totally different universe from the one he grew up in. In Thunder Bay, Ontario, Wedding had advantages that most Canadian children could only dream of. His father was a multilingual engineer, his mother Karen a nurse. His grandparents even owned Mount Baldy, a ski resort where he first learned to snowboard at age 12, winning the first race he ever entered. By age 15, he'd made the Canadian national team. His parents supported his ambitions fiercely, sometimes spending up to $40,000 a year on equipment, coaching, and travel expenses. They dressed the walls of their Whistler property with race bibs and framed photos, treating him like an athletic prodigy. But Olympic glory was now just a distant memory. He was barely even Ryan Wedding anymore, known instead by a series of different aliases: El Jefe, Giant, Public Enemy, James Conrad King, and Jesse King. But all of this makes you think, did he ever actually reflect on this incredible descent into darkness? What did the family feel when they saw the news headlines shout his name? His mum later pleaded to the media, "You can have every opportunity and still take the wrong path." That wrong path had seen Wedding climb to the top of a very different mountain from the one he had once honed his skills on, but it wasn't long before an impending avalanche would see it all crash back down to earth. You see, every empire has a weak point. Wedding's downfall didn't come from some major operation, it started with something much smaller. The hitman we mentioned earlier, Mr. Perfect, the one who killed Randy Fader, thought he'd pulled off a clean job, but he hadn't. And after the police tracked him down and arrested him, they linked him to Andrew Clark and a list of other people that Wedding allegedly wanted dead. The phone evidence connected Fader's murder to two other killings: Mohammed Zafar, a man shot in Brampton, Ontario, over alleged drug debts, and the more disturbing case of Jagdar and Harbhajan Sidhu. The Sidhus, a married couple in their 50s visiting from India, had been staying with their daughter in Ontario when a gunman burst into their home on November 20th, 2023. Both parents were killed instantly, and their daughter was shot 13 times but miraculously survived. And in a heart-wrenching interview, she describes hearing her mother's final screams.
"My father was shot in front of me. I heard my mother's last screams, and after that, it was complete silence. Only the noises of gunshots were there."
The investigators determined the family were victims of mistaken identity, as the house had previously been rented by a drug courier who had allegedly disappeared with a cocaine shipment belonging to Wedding's organization. The innocent family had paid with their lives for someone else's betrayal. And by October 2024, authorities had gathered enough evidence to launch coordinated raids across multiple countries, all as a part of a giant operation named Giant Salaam. A name chosen purposefully because Wedding was the primary target. On October 8th, Mexican naval forces stormed a restaurant in Guadalajara and arrested Clark. But this wasn't a routine police operation, as Mexican armed forces are only typically deployed for high-value targets. And with Wedding's right-hand man down, the plot surrounding his operation unravels rapidly. Roughly a week after Clark's arrest, authorities in Miami raided a multi-million dollar mansion that once belonged to DJ Khaled and arrested its owner, who turned out to be a music executive at the popular restaurant in Miami Beach. According to court documents, the man had been threatened by Wedding over a 5 kilo cocaine debt, with Wedding allegedly warning he would kill the executive's mother if the debt wasn't paid. That raid resulted in another arrest and yet more leads. and things just continued to snowball from there. And by the time this giant operation was concluded, 12 members of Weddings' crew, including Clark and Mr. Perfect the Hitman, had all been arrested. Now only 4 remained at large, including Wedding. In total across the operation, authorities seized approximately 1,800 kilograms of cocaine and over $250,000 in cash and $3.2 million in cryptocurrency. Yet, Wedding himself remained elusive. According to Estrada, he was hiding under the protection of the cartels somewhere in Mexico. And on March 6, 2025, the FBI took the extraordinary step of adding Wedding to its top 10 most wanted fugitives list, offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to his capture, one of the largest bounties in the entire program's history. Writing in an FBI blog post, Akil Davis, the assistant director of the FBI's Los Angeles field office, states, Wedding went from shredding power on the slopes at the Olympics to distributing powder cocaine on the streets of US cities and in his native Canada. The alleged murders of his competitors makes Wedding a very dangerous man, and his addition to the list of 10 most wanted fugitives, coupled with a major reward offer by the State Department, will make the public our partner so that we can catch up with him before he puts anyone else in danger. Court records also state that he was connected to some of the most dangerous criminals in the world. Dirty ex-Russian KGB agents, Iranian encryption experts, Hezbollah-connected narco-terrorists, and the infamously violent Sinaloa cartel. So at this point, you have to be thinking what's going on in Weddings' mind, all as his empire begins to crumble around him, and he sees his face now next to some of the most awful criminals in recent history. Even though Wedding seems fearless and never shows signs of feeling sorry for what he's done, it must still be hard to completely erase who he used to be. And the question is, why is he doing this? Is it literally just for money? Well, it's easy to assume his drug empire was just about money. But this guy started with advantages most people don't have. Supportive parents, athletic success, even a $250,000 loan from his dad. He's definitely not the typical person in the cartel. From Canada with privilege, money, and family support, and yet nothing protected Wedding from his twisted destiny. And it's really an extraordinary psychological study, as maybe this was never really about getting rich, and maybe he was instead addicted to risk itself. I mean, just looking at how his crimes kept on escalating, it wasn't always just about being more profitable, but always just about what's more dangerous. And for a guy wired for extreme challenges, perhaps the criminal underworld was the only world where he could find risks big enough to make him feel alive. And now today, the hunt for Ryan Wedding remains inconclusive. Kalina, the FBI agent who first arrested Wedding in 2008, is skeptical about his ability to remain hidden indefinitely. As he said, he's in a part of the world where he's gonna totally stick out, and I don't see him being the kind of guy who's okay hiding out in a bunker for the next 20 years. But others aren't so sure. One law enforcement believes that the value of Wedding to the Sinaloa cartel may protect him indefinitely. As long as he can keep paying his taxes to the cartel, they'll continue to shield him from authorities. In November 2024, the FBI released an updated photo of Wedding taken earlier that year. The long stringy hair from his previous wanted poster had been cut short, and his features appeared hardened by years in the criminal underworld. A stark contrast to the face in the Olympics. And somewhere, perhaps in a luxurious hideout in the Mexican countryside, the former snowboarder continues his insane life, and we most likely have not heard the last of it yet.